So needless to say, I'm odds and ends, but that's me, I'm stumbling away. Slowly learning that life is okay, and say after me, it's no better to be safe than sorry, and take on me. Take me on. I'll be gone in a day or two.
Okay, so today we are joined by Kevin Smith for a few questions about his movie and a lot more questions about general filmmaking and his life. So let's cut right to the hard questions. It's about Chasing Amy, actually. So Chasing Amy, which came out in 1997, was a movie that I really liked for really personal reasons. I also have a past, so it's kind of my shit test for guys. But a lot of people criticize the movie for not using the term bisexuality when it comes to Alyssa's sexual orientation. What motivated that choice on your side?
Well, Chasing Amy, now more than ever, is a kind of problematic film for some folks because, you know, it was made by a straight guy who's now a middle-aged fucking man, 23 years ago at this point. So when it came out, it was ahead of its time and very forward-thinking. But, you know, now if you're LGBTQ or SGL in this day and age and you watch Chasing Amy for the first time, like, it doesn't have the impact. It doesn't seem...
Yes, it still does. I am bisexual and I'm not one of the ones who took offense with the fact that you don't use the word, but I still think it's a missed opportunity.
What is the missed opportunity that we don't say she's bisexual?
Yeah, because bisexuality has been very invisibilized in movies and in pop culture in general. So I feel like it's the best movie about bisexuality who never dares to speak the word. So was it more like not a word that you used back in those time? I noticed that in Jay and Silent Bob, you also use the word gay to reboot. Yep. You also use the word gay.
Yes. At this point, let's just say that Alyssa has not been with another guy since Holden, so 22 years. So I would assume by this point, she's married to a woman. She identifies as gay. In the 90s, when we made the movie, particularly in 1996, bisexuality existed, but it wasn't as prevalent, and people didn't identify as bi. And the story itself, of course, was predicated on Scott Mosier's relationship with Gwen Turner, the writer and star of a movie called Go Fish, which came out in 1994. They were very close, but Gwen is gay. And so, you know, I was told Scott, I was like, you should write a movie about this, about like how you're obviously falling in love with a gay woman. And he's just like, I'm not going to do that. And I said, I'll do it. So I, rather than just do that story by itself, since that wasn't my experience, right, I kind of grafted the story, me and Joey's story, the story of our relationship, where I was very much like Holden, who was very like, how many people have you been with and stuff? Very distrusting, very low self-esteem, paranoid that she was going to leave me and stuff like that. So that gets grafted onto the original idea of a story about a man who falls in love with a lesbian. And naturally, since it was 1996 and I was, you know, a straight white male, I didn't go for the subtle nuance between the two.
But you did on some part the scene where lesbian friends reject her. Mm-hmm. That's very common in the gay community to reject bisexual people.
That came from Gwen, because Gwen had told me that like,
okay,
the moment there's in the case of Alyssa, where, you know, it's revealed that she's with a guy. I think when Gwen read the script, she was just like, you should have a scene in her world and they would be upset. Because she told me, she's like, there's definitely going to be some lesbians, Kevin, who really take offense to this because they don't sleep with guys. And you have, you know, your main character here, who's out and devout and proud lesbian, identifies as a lesbian, like having sex with a guy. And she's like, now, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. She goes, it does happen, but nobody just wants to talk about it and you might get some pushback. So I've included the scene where her friends, you know, kind of like react to Holden being a dude based on what Gwen had said. But yeah, I mean, in retrospect, like now from 2020, it probably would have been smarter to identify her, and more honest, to identify Alyssa as bisexual and not a lesbian. But when we start our story, Alyssa identifies as that. She doesn't really go.
But she still already slept with guys, so it's kind of denial on her part.
Yes. But it's, you know, she's the.
She's constructed this persona as a lesbian and she doesn't want to get out of it.
Yes. And also I feel like as written, Alyssa was more fluid than most lesbians would be with their sexuality. Like, you know, like we say, she's bisexual. The mistake was you have a movie written by somebody who literally was just learning about the gay community in the early 90s before he takes this haphazard kind of stab at this. And so, you know, to me, it was like, well, there's gay people and straight people, but now we know there's a spectrum across which there are a lot of different folks that don't fall into those two very basic categories. So in a world without LGBTQ, SGL,
IA.
Yeah, it's an IA. It's just, you know, a person who is like, oh, there are gay people and there are straight people. We live in a far more enlightened environment now. Like if one was to do Chasing Amy today, it wouldn't be what it was, right? It probably wouldn't even be Alyssa as a bisexual. Like it would probably be maybe transgender oriented in order to, you know, play more, be more relevant in today.
Those times, yeah.
Whereas 1997, that was like, believe it or not, that was like, oh my God, this is finger on the pulse, forward thinking. We haven't seen this before. And, you know, a couple of years ago here in town, I think it was Outfest, said, hey, come speak at a 20th anniversary screening of Chasing Amy or something. And I felt like, I was like, of course, I'll go anywhere anybody asked me to go. But I did feel kind of strange. But, you know, their point was like, it's a milestone of sorts in gay cinema. Yes, you're not gay, but like this movie is important to a bunch of people. I mean, even as problematic as it can play today in 2020, I still meet, and I can say this like with recent knowledge, because we went on the Jay and Silent Bob Reboot Roadshow tour. I met so many women who were like, Alyssa was my touchstone. Alyssa was the first character I saw in a movie that I made me feel like that's me.
Yeah,
that's
that was awesome. Kind of the same for me.
That's beautiful. But like, you know, it's, I understand folks being like, well, you weren't gay. And this whole story would be better told from Alyssa's perspective rather than Holden's and stuff. But at the same time, and
I'm not sure because, I found it over the years that it was a great test for guys. It's really a great test for test for guys. It's usually the first movie I show them on a date. Because
that's a tough first date, man. If you're like, now you watch your face.
I'm the incarnation of Netflix and chill. So, but I show them the movie, and regarding the way they react towards Alyssa, I can say it's a good guy. It's a guy that won't bullshit me about my past.
It's so amazing. I used to use Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing as my barometer movie, the movie that I could share with a girl, and based on her reaction, like.
Didn't you talk about it in your movie, in your book?
Probably Do the Right Thing. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies, one of my five favorite movies of all time.
Okay.
Like, it was a movie that, like, I could show girls. And if the girls were like, you know, why did he throw the garbage can through the window? Then I was like, okay, I
haven't seen Do the Right Thing.
It's a wonderful film.
Want to see it.
Made in 1989, the same year as Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, and the same year as Roger and Me, Michael Moore's documentary.
Okay.
But of those three movies, I would say that Do the Right Thing has aged the best.
You don't like Tim Burton's movie.
I do, though, to be fair. Like, all throughout the Reboot Roadshow tour, I kept describing the making of Jane Silent Bob Reboot as akin to the last 10 minutes of Big Fish.
Big Fish is one of my favorites. It makes me cry every single time.
Absolutely.
I have tears.
The finale, and when Albert Finney is carried through his life and he sees everybody who he met throughout the movie and they're all like loving on him and stuff.
One of my next questions is going to be somewhat related to that, because I feel that in Tusk, in some aspect, you did a darker version of Big Fish.
Yeah, maybe.
You'll understand later.
Yes, I could kind of see that. But to me, Reboot, Jane Silent Bob Reboot, and the making of the movie was very close to the experience of watching Big Fish. Like, I remember watching the movie.
I cried during the reboot of Jane Silent Bob. I was in tears multiple times. The reunion of Alyssa and Holden is just beautiful, and it's a perfect way to close the story.
I thank you for that, Aisha. What I loved about it was the last time we saw, like, Holden and Chasing Amy, you get the idea that, like, well, he broke that, but he'll be better. Like, he's learned something, and in the future, he won't be that person again.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that relationship, but he might be a better person. And then when we find him in Reboot, he is a better person. And he's an incredibly unorthodox relationship that's even more intimate than the previous incarnation.
With you.
So it's like, I when I watched that scene, I felt wonderful for all of them. I was like, my God, they all grew up, and he sensed that Alyssa was important to him, and he was absolutely right. And she remained important throughout his entire life. And now they're tied together with the kid. And the original draft of the script, like, they, you know, there, it was intimated that they had sex, and that's where the kid came from. Yeah. And Joey Adams read that scene and was like, don't do that. She said, I'm out there in the world. I go to conventions, wherever I go, and people who come up to me and talk about Chasing Amy, they all talk about how important the character is to them and stuff. And these are all mostly, of course, lesbians. So she's like, you'll really break their hearts and betray them if you
see. That would have broken my heart.
So she caught that. She was the one. She was like, well, I was like, well, if you guys don't have sex, how would they have a baby? And she goes, you know, IVF or like in vitro, man. Like, I was like, oh yeah, you're absolutely right. So thank God she, you know, fucking.
Thank God for the female in your life. They make great decisions for you.
Always, Aisha. They're always stopping me from getting into trouble.
Okay, so my next question is about Red State that came out in 2011. In your movie...
That's what I was showing at Neuchâtel when I was up there. Remember, it was right when I went to the Neuchâtel Film Festival, it was with Red State because
they made a retrospective over your movies.
Yes, and particularly Red State because that had been the last one. But I remember being up there and being like, I just made this movie called Tusk and I want to bring it back next year, but we never got to go back.
Oh, I have questions about Tusk. So Red State, it featured multiple very criticizing segments on police behavior with the rise of the Defund the Police movement lately. What's your opinion about this movement and the situation in America?
I mean, you know, Red State definitely is a post 9/11 kind of like, do we trust anyone? Do we trust the government? That I remember when we did it, I felt like, oh, this is too late. You know, it didn't feel like it was current. It felt like, oh, people have been distrusting the government for a long time. Now it seems very prescient in some weird way, to some degree. I'm not a big, I don't attack the police department and stuff like that. I've only, you know, I'm afraid of the police like everybody else, not probably less afraid than some people are afraid of the police. But police to me, I don't know why, it's not like I distrust them, but, you know, maybe it's because I'm a bad driver who drives recklessly a lot, but, you know,
Because you smoke weed in the street.
Probably that could have
at your hotel balcony.
That could have something to do with it. But I've always been afraid of like getting in trouble. So when I think of the police, I don't think of them as an organization an institution. I just think of them as like, oh, that's. Those are the people that could put me in jail, like if I do something, or sometimes if you don't do something. I don't know. Like, so I'm not a person that dislikes police at all, but I've, you know, grew up like everybody else, cautious of the police because that's how you get in trouble. And the moment I got a license, I started getting pulled over by police and stuff like that. So I, you know, but I've had relatives in the police department. So I'm not somebody that's like, oh my God, they gotta go. I don't think it's wrong to be like.
But do you agree on the basic idea of defunding the police? I was about to say,
like, in terms of how much money is spent on like urban assault vehicles and things like that, seems kind of unnecessary. So a lot of people out here when they hear defund the police, they think, you know, it means like you are against the police. I'm not against the police by any stretch of the imagination. We need them. But do I think the police need an urban assault vehicle? Like, even in the midst of the protests that have been going on for months, still the answer would be no. Like, that is a vehicle that looks like it's built for war, for heaven's sakes. It looks more threatening than, like, you know, than the Chris Nolan Batmobile. So to that degree, like, absolutely, I would say, like, perhaps less money being spent on unnecessary artillery, you know, when we're not at
and
war.
And more for social workers and that kind of stuff.
That kind of thing where, you know, and look, I mean, I guess my point is like my whole life, whenever I've needed the police, and it's been very few times, but, you know, if I've had to call the police or whatever, I was happy they showed up. Absolutely. But mostly my whole life, I've always been, you know, nervous about getting in trouble. Even when I'm not like, I don't do anything like where I'm not like at criminal activity all the time. But even from a young age, there was always this kind of like nervousness about the police. I think a lot of people, if I feel that way, you know, obviously we know in the Black community, some people won't even call the police because they're more terrified of the police than like a crime in progress. So the elimination of urban assault vehicles and, you know, artillery that looks like it's more for the war battlefield than for an American town or city. I'm definitely all for, particularly if you're saving that money, maybe you're putting it into neighborhood groups where, you know, they don't necessarily have to send a cop car. Like, you know, there are programs where they have like essentially deputized individuals within the community who like they get called instead of somebody with a gun showing up. I mean, that's, you know, there's fundamentally nothing wrong with the idea of a police force, but like, there is something also fundamentally scary about if you call somebody to be like, you know, there's some kids in my backyard that shouldn't be there. The people that show up have guns. Like, that's just a part of their job. And I'm not saying eliminate guns. Of course the police should have guns. But like, maybe that's somebody, you know, maybe you don't need the police to deal with that situation. Maybe you need an in-between, a deputized body that, you know, is community-based, that that is there to intervene, and maybe we save the police for the things that require guns to be at play.
I agree with you. John Oliver made a great segment on that, actually.
Who did?
John Oliver.
John Oliver, yes.
Last Week Tonight is John Oliver.
I love Last Week Tonight. Do you guys get it the same time we do, or are you like a week?
It's on YouTube, so...
So you watch it instantly?
Yeah.
Oh, he's
let's skip to Tusk.
He did a Chasing Amy joke on his show once, and it was about Ben Affleck, because it was like they brought it up as in reference as a negative. Like, this is a movie where it says Ben Affleck could, you know, make a lesbian want to have sex with him or something like that.
Okay, I didn't remember.
I love John Oliver so much that like I was like, the poster for Chasing
Amy. I can imagine.
Last Week Tonight. And one other time, too, he called somebody a business casual Kevin Smith. And that
You're someone. Okay, so let's skip to Tusk. 2014. So I always saw Tusk not only as a horror movie, but also as a dark tale on the power of storytelling, a meta commentary on how far we can go for a good story. In your case, writing a movie about a fucking walrus suit. Was that your original intent, or am I reading too much into this and it was simply the wish fulfillment of the fun idea you had improvising the movie on your podcast?
What a great question. It began once I got a bunch of people hashtagging walrus yes on Twitter. It began more as a like, this would be a fun way to make a dream come true. Like, I like this episode of the podcast. Let's see if we can do this. So it started initially with goals no more aspirative than, you know, oh, let's just get the thing done to see if we can do it. But then as I was writing it, it became this kind of metaphor for storytelling. And, you know, so
because you had such a magnetic orator in Michael Parks. The guy is made, and you had so many references to The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, to Tennyson, and I really appreciated that because it was probably the only time my English literature master came useful. But to me, yeah.
It was
so, sorry.
No worries. It very much along the way became an elegy, if you will, for storytelling. Like right up to the marketing campaign, the tagline for the poster was "Let me tell you a story."
Okay. I had never seen the poster for Tusk. I'm a huge fan of Red State.
Let me see if I could take you to the one out in my office. The outer.
Okay,
office.
Thanks.
Hold on. Whoa. There's a dog. Gotta keep the dog separate. All right. So this.
Oh yeah, I remember.
But if you look real close on the tagline was, "Let me tell you a story."
That's beautiful. Poster. Do you have the one for Red State as well?
Do I have the Red State poster? Not in this room. There's a Tusk head.
I think. Oh wow, the Tusk has Edward. Excellent.
Isn't it sweet?
That's creepy. That's
but
creepy.
I loved the Red State poster. And you're right. I don't have one in the house. You're just reminding me. I got to get one of those framed. I have a Red State tour poster that's framed somewhere. So it's like the poster and then it has a bunch of dates. But I love that poster. It's so beautiful, man. And there was, it was like a girl in the office, a PA, who came up with the poster, who just like took some of the artwork and put a film on it. And I was like, that fucking rocks.
So apart from that, in Tusk, you have a character say that cringe, and I'm quoting, cringe humor attack shit is lame. Is that something you feel yourself?
The cringe humor is lame? It's, I don't know. I don't know that I would phrase it as lame, but I'm not a big fan of cringe humor. I like watching it. I wouldn't do it myself. I have a hard time.
Yeah, you seem too nice to do cringe humor.
I have a hard time making people feel uncomfortable. Most of my humor, at least like when I'm standing up and talking, is more pointed at myself. I don't like to go out at others and cringe. You know, there's a school of cringe humor that is, you know, self-reflective and stuff like that.
So do you like shows like Review with Forrest McNeil or Nathan For You?
Which one? Who?
A Review with Forrest McNeil and Nathan For You.
Who is Forrest McNeil?
It's a fictional host of a TV show.
Which show?
A Review with Forrest McNeil.
That's a TV show?
Yeah.
Where is it? Is it UK?
It just came out on DVD, but it was the US version. It's brilliant. It's we are rewatching it currently, so it's really excellent. It's
cringe based?
Not really cringe, more kind of an elevated cringe, I'd say.
Where do you consider the original British Office?
Very, very cringe.
Yes,
not as much as some of Jarvis stuff, but very cringe.
I could watch that all day. I absolutely love it, but I can't do it myself. Like,
I think you'd like Review. Have you seen since we last talked, Community?
Still no. I still have not ever seen Community. Jan, you jumped.
Do you watch Rick and Morty?
Yes, I love Rick and Morty.
So I kind of advised you, Dan Harmon. I'm kind of responsible for that. I'll take that credit.
I love Rick and Morty. It's one of my favorite things in the world. Like, it's.
Do you plan a cameo on it?
I would, if they ask me, in a heartbeat. I love Justin, and I've had Dan on my podcast, and Justin know in the real world and stuff. And he has another cartoon now on Hulu. Have you seen?
Solar
Opposites.
What?
Solar Opposites, it's called.
Okay, no, I haven't seen it.
It's wonderful. It is Rick and Morty but without Dan Harmon. So
okay, so it must be less sad.
Yes.
But I have to admit, I love the sad aspect of Rick and Morty.
Me too. One of my favorite fucking moments in Rick and Morty. Look, I love when they show heart, when they lean into the heart, because it's so rare. But I loved the one episode, the end of the episode where he was, what was her name? He was having the relationship with the Borg collective lady, the lady who was a whole planet.
Yeah.
But not the
Unity.
Unity, yes. And at the end
of the episode, that's my favorite episode as well.
He's in the garage and he's like creates
trying to kill himself, but no one notices it. That's
mind bending.
It made me cry for days.
Me too. I thought that was some of the bravest fucking cartooning, like comedy, entertainment, bravest statement in art ever made. I was like, everybody knows that moment in their life, and I've never seen that represented on a screen. It was incredible.
Yeah, I'm very glad. You should watch Community.
Sooner or later. I mean, I guess they only got to what, six seasons?
Six seasons, yeah.
I sooner or later I should, but I love Justin, and I love his cartoon, his Solar Opposites cartoon. So I did like a event for them, like when they were launching it and stuff. So I don't know. Hopefully one day, you know, I'm certainly not going to bully my way into it, but if they
ask. Did you know that I actually signed a book in which I had written an article about him to him? Yeah. When I went to see his podcast in Los Angeles, and afterwards a friend dragged me to the scene, and I told him that I had written this article about him and him and myself, and that it was mostly about honesty. And he said, does anyone have a Sharpie? And I thought that he was going to sign it for me. But he asked me, can you sign it for me?
And this was Dan?
Dan Harmonier.
So you went to Harmontown?
Yeah.
How was it?
It was great. It was a great experience.
When was
it? I even shouted the 9/11, if you know it.
No, I don't.
It's a tradition in the podcast to shout 9/11 when it's 9/11.
That's hysterical. Where was the show? Was it at his castle, the place that he built?
No, it was still in a comic book store.
Now, from what I understand, he built himself a castle and that's where he does it.
Okay. So my next question is on the anthology movie you took part of called Holidays that came out in 2016. First of all, I loved your segment. It was very female empowering. What gave you the idea to write about cam girls and the people exploiting some of them?
Did you see the Netflix documentary?
I was sure of it. Rashida Jones, Hot Girl Wanted.
Yes. I watched that documentary and I was like, this is a horror movie. So right then and there, I was like, I'm going to do that.
Did you know that by doing that documentary and the series following after, she actually outed a lot of cam girls who were not out to their family because she put them in the fucking opening team?
They were in the background. Yeah. Yes, I heard that.
Yeah.
That was bad.
That's terrible.
And also,
I have mixed feelings about those predictions.
Yes. But even worse, there were nobody corrected it.
Yeah, there was a very judgmental feel to the show, like sex is bad, sex industry destroys women, etc. And there was no real good example of it.
No, but also nobody corrected, like, you know how you said it outed some people because their images were.
Oh, yes, I didn't remember.
All anyone had to do was just cut those out. And that could happen anywhere along the way and could still happen right now. I think it's strange.
But that's because they don't really care about sex workers.
I guess that's what it is.
So final question. Once again, a question about Southland Tales.
Hold on. Let me ask you about Holidays. Did you watch the whole movie?
Yes, I did.
Wasn't the Jesus bunny the most fun?
Yes. That was one of my favorite.
Mine too. I saw that and I was like,
that's creepy and fucked up.
Yes. Visionary as hell. I felt lucky to be in a movie with that segment because I was like, that's fucked up.
You know what? That question about Southland Tales, I'll ask it to you at the end if we still have time.
Okay.
So general questions now. I love Tough Shit that you published in 2012. It was hilarious and touching. Nice. Do you plan to write another book in the future?
I probably should. I should probably, because that book is a real cap to a career, has a real memoir feel to it where I'm like, and now I'm
done.
And then I wasn't done.
Yeah, definitely.
Bunch of other shit happened, including the heart attack. So I really feel like there's a heart attack book that I should write, you know.
Just I agree.
Essay that point and through the making of Reboot and stuff like that. And if I do it, I know I would want to call it Kevolution. So
that's cool.
It's a good title. So sooner or later, maybe I'll get to it. Now would have been the time as we were sitting around quarantine. But yeah, it's actually, now that you mentioned it, it's worth looking into.
Okay, so in the same vein as my previous question, do you plan to do more stand-up after your great Silent But Deadly?
My God, you're so sweet. Yes, we're doing, I obviously we've been kind of pushed off stage by COVID out here. I was just coming off of the Reboot Roadshow tour where we went 65 cities and saw like 1,000 people a night. And then backstage taking pictures with like 100 VIPs. And, you know, for me, when we were finished with the tour, I was like, I know exactly what we're doing next year. I'm going to make Clerks 3. I'm going to pay for it. It's going to be cheap. And then we're going to take it out and tour it like for a year, never mind 4 months. We're just going for a year straight. And obviously all of that just goes out the window until there's a vaccine. So we're shimmying now and trying to readjust. We did a drive-in event for my birthday where we showed Reboot and then I did a Q&A and it went smooth. So right away we were like, all right, so we could use this for the podcast. So we're about to announce a Hollywood Babylon drive-in show and then we'll be adding Get Old, then we'll be adding Smodcast. And then sooner or later, maybe I'll stand there by myself. Which I kind of did at my birthday. So there'll be a way to perform, but it's not, you know, it's not as ideal as it was, but.
But will we still have an option for overseas viewer to see it?
Yeah, I mean, for if we shoot everything, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
For sure, man. Like we shot, I think the drive-in thing we put on that Kevin Smith Club. There's a video, like a library in that Kevin Smith Club called the Smithsonian Screening Room, which has all these old videos from like the 90s and then the current stuff we do and shit. So I think it's in there now and it might shuffle out to our YouTube channel, like as an advertisement after that. Same thing with like the Hollywood Babylon one. Number one, of course, the audio will be shoved out, but the video will probably put up on the YouTube channel. Because it's, you know, in order to put us up on the drive-in screen, they shoot us with a camera and live stream it up to the screen. So that means there's a video file for it, just like this.
Okay, perfect. So my next question is again going to be a very serious one. Why jorts?
What a great question.
I put my heart into it.
It was a great one. If you look at, like, if you can look at the length of my career, my entire career, you could see that, like, when I find something that I really like or identify with, I just stick with it. Like, we just made another Jane Silent Bob movie 25 years after we made Clerks and stuff like that. So it makes a lot of sense. Sometimes I marry into an outfit for a long time. I was wearing hockey jerseys for like 10 years.
Oh, I love those jerseys.
Prior to that, the hoodies and stuff. And now I'm in suit jackets. But the jort.
You have to sell your jerseys.
We will. We'll put them back up. I took them down when I stopped wearing them because I thought people wouldn't give a shit anymore. But now people have been asking for them. So the notion of I changed the tops over the years, but I've kept jorts from day one. I think it's because I got very fat thighs. I got my mother's thighs. And
you don't have fat thighs anymore.
I still have fat thighs. I got childbearing hips and very large thighs. And they're thinner than they were, but they're still kind of chunky. But it's the jorts always allowed you to air out because when you have heavy thighs, that means you also have heavy calves. And when they scrunch up together, they get all sweaty and shit. So having jorts is better than shorts because jorts tend to be long, you know, thanks to the good folks.
I see.
Pinko, they go to the knees. So that comes up like the chub that builds up around the top or the bottom of your thigh, right above your knee. Like a lot of fat will compound and you could see like a roll of blubber. So having long shorts that like covered that part made me feel like a little more secure, even though my calves were pretty big and stuff like that. But my calves, because I have to carry the body around and the body was much heavier, are very like muscly and defined. My kid makes fun of me all the time. Like, she'll take pictures of me from behind to be like, look at the fucking gun show, because my calf muscles are so like on display and stuff. But my thigh, I have no thigh muscles whatsoever, but I do have pretty tight calf muscles. But George's, I honestly can't explain it. We just started talking to this new company about making a new set of jorts and stuff. And I was so relieved, because the jorts that I got working them right now, I'm like, the company's out of business. What will I do? But I don't know. I've really committed to them for some reason. It's not like my father wore jorts or something like that. It's just, the same thing with the backwards baseball cap. Like, I've tried to flip this shit around and I just look stupid. It's weird to me. I look like a child when I wear a baseball cap the right way.
Yeah.
But this way, I'm like, well, this makes sense. And I've married into this and never let it go. Same with the jorts.
Everything's been so messed up here lately. Pretty sure he don't want to be my baby. Oh, he don't love me, he don't love me, he don't love me, he don't love me, but that's okay. Cause I love me, yeah, I love me, yeah, I love me, yeah, I love myself anyway. Hey, everything's gonna be alright, everything's gonna be okay. It's gonna be a good, good life, that's what my therapist say. Everything's gonna be alright, everything's gonna be just fine. It's gonna be a good, good life. I'm a mess.
Okay, so I'd like to know more about your involvement in one of my favorite romantic comedies of all time. I remember watching it since I was a kid and dreaming that it would be my life. Coyote Ugly. What did you bring to it specifically?
I just did an interview about this because it's coming up on the 20-year anniversary or something like that.
Okay.
There's a big Coyote Ugly anniversary that's coming up.
That's great.
I think it's been out for two decades now. Maybe I'm wrong, but the it's going to be on the Ringer, that website. Some lady with the accent interviewed me about it, and I was like, Coyote Ugly. I was like, who? People talk about that still? And she goes, they do now. Because
did you bring the comic side?
I did not, and I told this lady that in the interview. I was like, honestly, like when I went to the premiere, and the premiere was right down the street from where I live now at the Chinese Theater here in Hollywood. When I went to the premiere, I was shocked at how little of my stuff that they used. They kept all the names that I changed and created, and they kept set pieces of where things happen, but they changed out like all the dialogue. And at the end of the movie, Jennifer was like, I don't remember, like, you put comic books in the movie. They kept that. And I was like, I didn't do that. I never put a comic book in the movie. So that was whoever came after me and stuff. So for years, people were like, you must have done that. I was like, I didn't. The one line of mine that I know is mine in that whole movie was Cammy, the character Cammy.
She
says, I think, what was the main character's name again? Piper's name? Piper?
Jersey.
Yes, obviously. I brought that part to it too. Violet, I think.
Oh, I was sure of it.
Yes. I made her dad like the toll booth guy. Like, I brought that in and stuff. But she's talking to Violet, and Cammy says something about being fucking around with girls. And she's like, oh, are you a lesbian or are you gay or whatever? And she goes, I know, I just played in the minors, but I never went pro. That's the only piece of my work left in Coyote Ugly in terms of sheer dialogue. I just assumed.
So you were not involved in the censored sex scene?
The which one?
There's a very odd sex scene in the movie that got censored.
I don't even think. Let me see. So wait, I was hired about a year after Chasing Amy, because Jerry Bruckheimer, who was the producer of the movie, he'd made like, you know, the big like fucking Top Gun and Armageddon, but he loved Chasing Amy. So he brought me in for that, for Coyote Ugly. So I think I was working on it like 99, 2000. Yeah, because the kid had just been born. So it was around 99, 2000. Then the movie came out in like, I guess, late 2000. But yeah, it was a weird experience. Not bad experience by any stretch of the imagination. But like I did a bunch of work on the script. And then when they brought the director in, he brought a different screenwriter in and they just kind of rewrote the dialogue for whatever reason. I was always mystified by that because I'm like, the only reason you hire me is to write dialogue. But like for some reason, they kept things that I did that weren't dialogue and got rid of most of the dialogue.
Okay, good story. Speaking about kid, in your opinion, has working with your daughter impacted your filmmaking apart from featuring her? Because I remember you wanted to stop making movies at one point. Has she given you a second wind?
Yeah, she made it interesting again. Like in as much as I'm like, oh, you like movies? Fuck, I used to do movies. Let's make a movie. So like as her interest in acting went, suddenly I got...
She was very good in Halloween. Your segment.
Yeah, I liked her very much in that. You know, unfortunately, not her first time up was Tusk, but her second time up was Yoga Hosers, and like the movie took a bunch of shit. But
I liked it.
Yeah, obviously I'm a fan, but
it wasn't really a good movie per se, but it was a good father-daughter movie. You could feel that you had fun, and so as the audience, you had fun as well.
For some, and then some people were like, fuck this movie. A lot of people were like, not into it.
Well, fuck these people.
But she was, you know, she, ever since she got interested in it, I got reinterested in movies where, you know, it really comes down to this. Like when she was a kid, I tell the story a lot, but it's true. There was a day we were playing hide and go seek in my bedroom, and there's like fucking three places to hide in my bedroom. And we were up to game 26 of hiding. Those kids love repetition. They can just do the same fucking thing over and over, expect a different result, and it don't happen. So about around the 27th fucking time, she was like, again, I was like, oh, kiddo, we've just played a bunch. I was like, go downstairs, see Nan and Pop. We'll play tomorrow. And we never played tomorrow, and we never played hide and seek again. And not in this tragic way, but just she grew up. We did other things. You know, it's not like she was left alone or something, but like, you know, I took for granted the fact that like there'll be more time to do this. And before you know it, time passes by and you are in a Harry fucking Chapin Carpenter song, Cats in the Cradle or whatever the fuck. So I always felt like, oh man, like that's it. I'll never play with the kid again. You know, she's too old now.
Well, now you're playing with her again.
With movies, that's it. You get to literally do the same shit we did when she was a little kid, where it's like, all right, you're pretend to be this person. I'm going to pretend like I don't even say anything and go. Pretend to be his daughter and go. So it is like getting another bite at the apple where you get to play with the kid again. And that's rare in adult world. I mean, I'm sure there are adult parents that play basketball or baseball or fucking sports with their kids, and that's a way to play. But I'm talking about the make pretend like way to play, and you get to do that on a movie set. So her being there, it makes it more fun for me, and hence made me more inclined to do it.
Can you give us some more details about the upcoming Clerks 3 and Mallrats 2? And also, why go back to those characters so long after leaving them?
I think I've been trying to get back to them for years. That's how we got to Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. It started off as Clerks 3, and Clerks 3 wasn't going to happen, so I turned it into Mallrats 2. Then that didn't happen. And then I hacked up those two scripts for parts, and that's what became Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. So for 5 years, well, 6 years, I was trying to make, 6 years back, I think, is the first time I put up cover page for the Clerks 3 script. It just, for one reason or another, I was thwarted at both attempts to do those movies. And then Jay and Silent Bob Reboot for me was like, well, like, this give me my chance to play with my toys again, and that'll be fine. But then Jay and Silent Bob Reboot kind of opened up the door to Clerks 3 and Mallrats 2 again. Universal co-financed Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. So suddenly it was like, oh, we maybe can do a Mallrats sequel.
Yeah.
And as long as it's cheap, why not? So it feels like, you know, I like playing with my old toys again. And that probably has a lot to do with the post-heart attack as well, where I'm like, this feels good. Like, you know, when you have a heart attack.
Yeah, and you have more stories to tell.
And it makes you feel like you're an old person, where you're like, because that's an old person kind of thing to happen. And being able to pull out the toys that I was playing with when I started my career, there's something, it makes you feel vital again. It's just fun. It's good times. It's nostalgia, but there's nothing wrong with that. So
yeah, nostalgia is the reason I cried watching the Jay and Silent Bob Reboot.
I know. I mean, that's honestly like, if for people who are like, I don't like Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, I'm like, then you're not going to like Clerks 3 or Mallrats 2 either, because it's the same sappy blend of like, here's some funny shit and here's some shit that's going to rip your heart out of your chest. Because that's all I'm interested in now, is ripping hearts out of the people's chests and whatnot, wearing mine on my sleeve and fucking like touching everybody else's hearts and stuff. I'm happy to try to make people laugh, but that I've been doing for, you know, like over 2 decades. It's more interesting and to me now to try to like fucking, you know, not so much tickle their funny bone as like touch their hearts instead.
Okay, so speaking about touching hearts, I really enjoyed the trailer for Kill While You Are Here. I heard about your project for Tusk 2. Does it mean that you plan on expanding your horror movie, your horror filmmaking filmography, and join the ranks of Red State, Tusk, and your segment on Holidays?
Yeah.
Because that would make me very happy.
Very much so. I mean, Kilroy will stand like shoulder to shoulder with those. I love it. It's plays like 80s slasher movie. And we made
I love slasher movies.
It's just so, it's like Creep Show because it's anthology, but it turned out really well. And we made it with a bunch of kids at Sarasota. In Sarasota at the Ringling College of Art and Design. So that was fun too, because you're surrounded by people who've not started their careers and none of them are jaded. And they're all like, oh my God, I can't wait to make movies and stuff. So it was such a wonderful environment to make it. I started it before the heart attack, then had a heart attack, and we finished it after the heart attack or stopped shooting after the heart attack. And then we went off and made Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. So it's been sitting there just kind of waiting for us to circle back to it. So during the quarantine, we've had plenty of time. So that's why we were able to put together a trailer to include on the Comic-Con thing.
So
it's going to be fun. Like in a world where we're talking about doing drive-ins, that's the perfect movie to take out to the drive-ins, man.
Yeah, I can imagine. We don't have drive-in in Switzerland, sadly.
I mean, it's easy to pull off, man. You just project against a building and a bunch of people sit outside, you know.
Yeah, that could be easy to pull off. So we all know your love for Degrassi and Veronica Mars. Are there other teen shows that you love?
Are there other what kind of shows?
Teen shows.
Teen?
Teen, yeah.
Let me think. I loved The Runaways.
Oh, yeah, I loved Runaways as well. I'm a huge fan of Brian K. Vaughan.
I thought they did such a really nice job with Runaways in terms of telling a teenage story. When I was Mallrats 2, or it's called Twilight of the Mallrats, is about Brody and his daughter Banner, and she's 16, 17. So I was very dialed in to Runaways because I was like, oh, that's how you do teenagers now. Like these teenagers. Because I can't do the Euphoria teenagers. You know, that's serious, like
the
TV show. And I loved that filmmaker's movie. What was it? Assassination Nation. But okay. I can't do those teenagers. They're so hardcore and real.
Yeah.
But I got to be able to do the John Hughes type teenagers. Like,
yeah,
I wrote for teens and he was not a teenager.
I was actually planning one time to write a book about teen show. It would have been an autobiographical essay about the teen shows that we had in my youth, such as Dawson, Young Americans, My So-Called Life.
My So-Called Life.
Everwood and all of that, because I'm kind of an expert on teen shows, so... but I gave up on that idea.
Do you watch Riverdale?
I watched part of it, but I follow a lot of TV shows, and at one point it was just too much.
Yeah, no doubt. Me and Jen were just talking about the other day how we don't rewatch movies like we used to. Like, we used to like go to bed and watch Bridget Jones's Diary every night for like a year.
Oh, one quick question. Did you watch Going the Distance? And is that the place where you discovered Justin Long?
Discovered who?
Justin Long from Tusk.
No. Justin Long, but the first time I saw him, he popped up on my radar, was in Galaxy Quest.
Okay.
He's in the third act. He's the little boy that like helps bring them home. But then I, you know, and I knew him from things like I'd seen him in movies. I always thought he was very funny until they made him the lead of things. Like, I remember I saw that movie Accepted and I was like, oh, that guy Justin is much funnier. Like,
yeah,
when not put in the lead. So I worked with him on Live Free or Die Hard, and I like got to see him like on set be the actor he was. And I absolutely loved it because every take was a completely different take. And you could tell like it irritated the fuck out of Bruce Willis. I mean, you know, I chalked that up to him like, oh, they've been together for months on the show. I got there at the tail end of the show. But I loved how every time Justin came in, it was fresh, but it was, and even though he was making up new dialogue, it was still germane to the discussion. So like, you know, he comes in and he's like, is that a bearded young Han Solo I see before him? That's the same thing he said when he came in the room, wasn't in the script at all. So I loved him. I was like, man, he's so clever. And then when we were doing Zach and Miriam Make a Porno, we, you know, needed somebody to be Brandon St. Randy. And I was like, oh, you know who was really fun was Justin Long. I when I was in that scene with him in Live Free or Die Hard, man, he was really funny. So yeah. Came out to Pittsburgh, and that was the first time that he worked with me for me. Like, I had worked with him on Live Free or Die Hard, but that was for Len Wiseman. The first time I worked with him where I'm like, okay, I need you to pretend to be this guy, was Zach and Miriam Make a Porno. And that was a funny scene, but those two dudes making dialogue up was one of my favorite things I've ever experienced professionally, if not personally. Like, they had a very funny concept of a scene to begin with, but they're both such wonderful ad-libbers that Justin and Seth just fucking kept like doing a better version of the scene, making me, I was like, you can hear me in the raw footage crying, laughing off fucking camera. So that was when I absolutely fell in love with Justin, where I was like, this kid could do anything. He is as expert an ad-libber as Seth. Like, he does your script. It's not like he throws your script out. He does your script, but then he ad-libs 10 funnier scripts, and they're all within context. So he's not just making up lines to make the crew laugh. He's making up dialogue that his character would make up. So then all of the footage becomes usable. So when Tusk was happening,
yeah,
wasn't the first guy I thought of, to be honest with you.
But he's perfect for the role.
But he was perfect. He was like the second or third person that I reached out to, and he made it better.
The first two ones?
Let me see.
If you're allowed to tell.
I could tell. I don't want to hurt people's feelings, but I could definitely tell. One of them was Paul Scheer.
And the second was Bruce Willis.
I think I might have reached out to him. No, I reached out to him for Red State. That didn't work.
Oh, no. That's Paul even Shearer. Red State.
And then who was, because I got to Justin by way of, what's his name? He won an Oscar, or he was up for an Oscar. Jonah Hill.
Oh, okay.
Jonah, he'd come over to the house to watch Zach and Miri, and he loved it and stuff. And he was like, please put me in something. And so I was like, that'd be kind of badass, man, him like playing this part and stuff, because the character was meant to be like obnoxious, and I knew Jonah could pull that off. But I reached out to him. He got back to me real quick, and he was like, that sounds amazing, but I think he was making 21 Jump Street at that point.
Okay.
If not that one or the sequel. So after that, I was like,
good movies.
Good, very funny movies. And the two guys that eventually gave us Into the Spider-Verse, like an amazing fucking movie.
Yeah. Oscar
movie. So it was because of the association that I had in my head with Jonah and Justin from Accepted that I was like, oh, what the fuck am I thinking? What about Justin? So I reached out to Justin, and Justin didn't want to do it. Like his agent begged him not to do it. His mom was like, don't ever get in touch with this boy again, meaning me. And then Justin like came over to the house, and he was like, I'll be honest, it terrifies me, but that's why I think I need to do it. He's going, this is the only thing I ever read that made me scared of doing it, but I think I should just face the fear and fucking do it. And so he had notes about his character, one of which was like, the original incarnation of Wallace, the podcast, was he was more of a sex tourist. So
okay.
he would go like to like Canada or fucking Neuchâtel or fucking Mexico and have sex with somebody and then come back.
I volunteer.
So I'll let him know. And then he'd come back and he would tell Teddy about it. And that's why it was a thorn in his relationship with Allie, because she was like, you can't keep doing this. And he was like, you knew who I was when we met. I do a sex podcast. He doesn't mean I don't love you, but in order to keep this business going, I got to keep having sex with strangers. And so Justin's thing was like, I think that's a stretch. He's like, that just seems he's going, but he's going, there are all these people that are like real nasty about people who get hurt on the internet. He was very specific about the Star Wars kid. He was like, that Star Wars kid, he's like, I saw a fucking story about how, you know, he was fucking like damaged by that incident because the world was cruel. So he's like, I think I should be one of those guys, a guy who like, I fucking go in and interview these people and then bring the story back for Teddy to listen to and stuff. But I'm more like cruel. Like it doesn't like, you know, people's hurt doesn't matter to me because that's how I make my living. That way, people will feel, you know, some sympathy for me when, or maybe they don't, he said, when like I get turned into a fucking walrus. Like I'm definitely getting taught a lesson, but we'll see. It'll divide the audience into like, well, fuck a lesson. This is inhumane. And people who are just like, good, serves him right because he does that podcast and shit like that, which was just more interesting than like me going like, he does a sex podcast. So I remember he came here in this very room and we smoked, and you know, I smoke a lot. He don't smoke that much. So he was blazed out of his mind and stuff. And I was just sitting there like processing everything that he was talking about while I was talking shit to him. And then he thought the next morning that like nothing was going to come of that conversation because we were too high. But instead I handed him another draft of the script the next night that incorporated everything he talked about and looks like Tusk does today. And he was like, holy shit. Like, he's like, you were listening? And I was like, yeah, man, you made valid points and shit. And it wasn't too difficult to go in and make new stuff. So he was a real collaborator on that flick. And, you know, from now until the end of time, I'll always try to put him in something. If he's free,
Please do.
Oh, I love it so much. He came back and did a version of Brandon St. Randy and Jay and Silent Bob reboot as well.
Okay.
Same delivery.
I'm just in love with him.
Yeah, he's amazing. As am I. He's such a wonderful actor too. Like, he's a very, very funny man.
I very much recommend Going the Distance.
I know it. That's the one.
It has Charlie Day as well.
Charlie Day's in it, yes.
And Jason Sudeikis.
Yeah, yeah. That was when he was with Drew Barrymore.
Yeah. They make a perfect couple.
That's the thing about like Justin that a lot of people never call attention to, but it's like he has honestly, like, he's such a down low charmer. Like, you know, nobody ever thinks of him as like the fucking sexy leading man and shit, but he has dated nearly every girl in this town. Like, you run.
Yeah, I know about that.
Yeah, he has been hooked up with some really like well known people, and like it's because I get it completely. You fucking have one conversation with him, he's charming as fuck. You just want to spend time with him. He's funny and shit. But a lot of women, you know, find him incredibly fucking sexy, which is something that would have never occurred to me. And not because I'm like he's a dude, but he's not even traditionally like. You know,
he's
somebody,
even sexy with a mustache.
That's so fucked up to say. That's so strange to me. Like, you tell me.
You know, the first time I saw Tusk, I was like, okay, the mustache is not doing it for me. But by the second time, I was like, I can't deal with that.
You tell me, like, Chris Hemsworth is sexy. I'm like, oh, I get that. That's amazing. I find him sexy. But, like, Justin, it just never occurred to me. But, like,
but Justin has this geeky charm.
It's and it's well warranted. I mean, look, again, you put him in a room with anybody for 2 minutes, I understand him flipping them. I understand people being like, oh my God, I'd fuck his brains out. But like at first glance, he doesn't occur to me as the kind of guy that women go after, but they do, even on a physical level. They fucking like him because, like you said, he's got this like geeky charm to him. He has done incredibly well over the course of his romantic career.
Yeah, I know. It breaks my heart, but I know.
There's still time. He's not taken? I don't think so. I
have all my chances then.
It is.
You just need to bring him with you when you come to Neuchâtel.
You should tell. For somebody who is willing to fly out to see Harmontown, you might be willing to fly out to see Justin Long in one of his plays. I mean, nobody's doing anything now, but he does every summer. He goes back east and does like in Connecticut live theater. Like he's
oh my God. Tight.
If you think you love him now, he's super tight with Sam Rockwell. And wow. Sam Rockwell is his idol, and they're very good friends. And he takes a lot of his performance beats, like, are very Rockwellian and inspired. And so he sent me a picture the other day, Justin did. And in the background, there's this framed poster for the Matt Dillon movie Flamingo Kid. And so I was like, what's with the poster? And he goes, you would notice that. He goes, well, that came from Rockwell. He's going, because I told him at one point that, like, when I was a kid, I loved Flamingo Kid. And he went out and got the poster and had Matt Dillon personalize it and sign it to Justin. So it's a personalized Flamingo Kid poster from Matt Dillon to Justin.
That's amazing. Do you hear a weird sound?
That was not me.
Oh, sorry. There were fireworks in my city, apparently.
Oh, you guys are celebrating. Because you only have 200 cases of COVID a day over here.
Okay, so sorry for derailing the question, but Tusk is really a favorite of mine. Still about teen shows, but now that you are working with your daughter and considering how well you wrote a father-daughter relationship, have you ever entertained the idea of writing your own teen show?
Yeah, the closest I've gotten is the Twilight of the Mallrats script. Very, you know, a lot of teen characters, and half of it is set in teen world. I could totally get my head around it. Like that would be amazing. That would really scratch the John Hughes itch of like, oh my God, a way to tell stories where you're not talking down to your audience, you're kind of sharing them and their perspective.
I can see you doing one of those old school teen show where What I like about old school teen shows is that in most of them there was no supernatural element, and it was just the life of kids.
That's
basically the premise of my book.
That's awesome. Yes, nowadays there has to be like somebody's got their teens, but they got superpowers, or their teens, but there's somebody's dead and it's a murder mystery, or you know, their teens.
Or there's a blackmailer or something like that, or there are vampires and so on.
I mean, honestly, Degrassi like was a perfect teen franchise. Like, never talked down to the kids.
I really enjoyed Degrassi as well. Yeah. I thought that I was hallucinating the day I saw you in it. So looking back at the beginning of your career, did you have a master plan for the Viewask universe and its many intercrossing? What was behind the idea of joining every movie with the next one? Did you make it up as you went along, or did that reflect something you wanted to accomplish all along? And it's a question that comes from Thibaut Turcas from Any Given Film. He made podcast before because of you, and he's the one. It was my first podcast actually. Now he makes movies.
Get out of here. Right on, man. Good for him. That's tremendous. Let me see. No, there was no plan for the Askew universe, although I did want to keep using Jane Silent Bob. You know, when I wrote Clerks, I had already written Dogma. There was a version of Dogma that existed
before. Okay.
So I knew that Jane Silent Bob I wanted to keep him around. The next movie we set up was Mallrats, and I knew I wanted to bring Jay and Silent Bob into those. And that was really like when we made Mallrats, the only real connection between the two movies was Jay and Silent Bob. And at one point we had a shot with a TS's car drove past Quick Stop. And that was about it. Then we tested the movie and the opening was too long. It took 30 minutes for them to get to the mall. On the DVD, they've got the old opening of the movie where TS is on the rooftop with Brandy. So when we reshot the opening of the movie, that was when I wrote the bit with Julie Dwyer in the pool at the YMCA, which makes it a universe. Suddenly you're like, oh, they know about the events of Clerks. And so then Chasing Amy, I was like, oh, I'm going to use that as well, like in the scene where Joey and, well, where Alyssa and Holden meet, they're going to reference shit that we know from Clerks. Like, you know, my best friend fucked a dead guy in the bathroom and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, and then of course, Jay and Silent Bob showing up makes it even more of a world. And then Dogma, we kind of, you know, Jay and Bob tie it to New Jersey and we head back to New Jersey. And at the end of the movie, they're like, we should go to Quick Stop. But other than that, it's not deeply ingrained in the Isk universe. You know, there's not much Jersey going on until the last act. But I remember there was a movie I wanted to do after Chasing Amy called Name, which we were going to tie Jay's character to Rick Darris's character. You were going to find out they were related.
Okay.
But we never got it.
Okay. That's too bad. So you accomplished the dream of many geeks with the opening of your DVD/comic shop, Laser Blazers. You had one in Los Angeles with many props from your movies. How did you manage it? And did that fulfill a wish you had? And also, why did it went away in 2011, 2012?
We had Jay and Silent Bob Secret Stash lived, well, of course, it's still in Red Bank, New Jersey. But we had at one point a Jay and Silent Bob Secret Stash out here in California. First, it was in Westwood. Then at one point, we were going to, after it lasted 5 years, and then we were going to shut it down. But then Laser Blazer, which was a DVD and Laserdisc store over on Pico, which was a couple miles away, They said, why don't you bring it here? Ron, the guy that owned Laser Blazer, was like, why don't you bring the secret stash here? So for a good year, we moved the secret stash inside Laser Blazer. And then eventually we wound up closing down a Los Angeles or California presence altogether. It was a shame, but like, to me, the secret stash needs to have somebody from our world in it. Like originally when
Andrew Ring was working at Laser Blazer.
The one in Los Angeles, like at one point in Westwood, Brian Johnson was working there. So that makes sense because he was in the movies and stuff. But then out here, like there was nobody connected to the movies and stuff. So eventually we just kind of stopped doing it. And then that's at the same time, well, not the same exact time, but right around then or a year or two later is when Comic Book Men started happening, the TV show that we did about Stash. And so right before Comic Book Men happened, we were thinking about closing the stash in Red Bank. I was like, well, you know, it's been 15 years or whatever. This is maybe we let it go now. It's time. We're not making any more movies with Jay and Silent Bob. Maybe it's time to let it go. And then suddenly Comic Book Men happened and kind of breathed new life into it.
Okay. So one last question about Southland Tales. We talked about it the first time around a bit.
He's good. Do you know that he's, have they announced anything about the forthcoming DVD?
I don't think so. But maybe I'm not following too closely.
I think, did you see the Arrow Donnie Darko DVD?
The Arrow Donnie Darko?
Arrow video did a Donnie Darko.
The one with the director's cut?
I think. It's the most recent Donnie Darko pressing somebody did.
I'm not sure I have it.
I think there might be something like that coming for Southland Tales.
Okay, that would be great.
Yes.
I would love it if they included the canned cut. Because you can find it on the internet. I did find it, and I also liked it.
I bet you that will happen sooner or later.
My question is, since we last talked about it, there has been a critical reconsideration for that movie, recognizing it for what it was. I remember that you told me even you didn't get that movie when we first talked about it. Yes. What are your thoughts on that re-evaluation?
I still don't quite understand the movie, but even though I didn't understand it then, and I'm in it, it never meant I didn't like it. I was always thought it was incredibly ambitious and wonderful. But I'm glad people are catching up with it. I thought it deserved a lot better treatment than it got. Poor Richard, like, always got kicked in the balls. Donnie Darko came out and a lot of people shit on it. And it wasn't until Home Video people started finding it. So the same kind of thing happened to Southland Tales. I mean, he had The Rock in a movie before.
An amazing Rock. I re-saw the movie this afternoon, actually. Yeah. And The Rock is so good in it, and so is Justin Timberlake, and so is Amy Poehler, so is every single member of the cast.
The Rock, and it's I remember sitting there and watch, because I'm in that scene at the end with me and him and Zelda and Curtis Armstrong, and it was 3 a.m, and he was like wired, and he was so serious about it. And I'm pretty sure that's like the first movie he did, like his first substantial lead in a movie. I remember being impressed on that night, like, wow, this guy's going to go far. And he fucking very much went far, but he was such a nice guy and so committed, so serious about the craft. I'm glad people are reconsidering it. That being said, I hope there's a world where one day Richard shoots his original script. You know, in a world where we have released.
Yeah, I dream of that too.
Did you ever read the original script?
No, because if it ever comes out, I want to enjoy it. But I read the prequel comic books.
Yes, wonderful. But we helped make those books. Those were so great.
You did?
Yeah, through Graffiti Designs. I co-financed those books.
Thank you very much.
They're good. Like, Richard had a grand vision for the whole thing, and he knew that I made comics, so I was like, we can do them through Graffiti Designs. So that's good for... I'm glad the movie's being reconsidered, because not many people got to see all those wonderful comic books, and now they will get a chance. You know, now suddenly it'll be fresh on people's minds.
Have you ever heard of the poem The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot?
What is it?
The Wasteland. Well, you see how complicated it is to understand, and how filled with references to other stuff filled off. To me, Southland Tales is like the 21st century version of what The Wasteland was for its time.
And he quotes the movie, doesn't he? I mean,
he doesn't quote this one. He doesn't quote The Wasteland. He quotes This Is the Way the World Ends.
Yes, you're right. My bad. Excellent point.
So thank you for answering all my questions. If I may make a small suggestion to you, I think you should really write that teen show. And I think you should consider the possibility of adding a character, maybe she's an exchange student, you know, from France or Switzerland, and I still look 18, so I can do it.
Done and done.
If you need someone.
We'll definitely need a young French teacher, for heaven's sakes, the very least.
Oh, yeah. I can do the French teacher as well.
My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. Damn right, it's better than yours. I can teach you, but I have to charge my milkshake.